Yep. Morning.
Whoa. Do you mind if we have it open?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, but there are four of us and we'd like it open. That's if it's all the same to you, that is.
It isn't. I travel on this train regularly, twice a week. So I suppose I've some rights.
So have we.
Then we'll have that thing off as well, thank you. But an elementary knowledge of the Railway Act would tell you that I'm perfectly within my rights.
Yeah, but we want to hear it. There's more of us than you. We're a community, and majority vote up the workers and all that stuff.
Then I suggest you take that damn thing into the corridor, or some other part of the train, where you obviously belong.
Give us a kiss.
So there we have that famous train scene from A Hard Day's Night, wherein there's all this stuff going on between the Beatles, you know, put up against this authority figure, this businessman that comes to occupy their train car, you know, between the window and then Ringo flicking on the radio. And you hear that 6 seconds of music. And as you know, Richard, that became a thing this year when all the speculation surfaced as to, was that the Beatles?
You know, oh, my God. Yeah. I mean,
it's... well, it's the 50th anniversary of A Hard Day's Night, so that I think was kind of prompting things.
But the thing is, though, it's like everyone got really hung up on that, you know, basically was like an excerpt of sort of surf music, sort of twangy surf guitar sound, and the speculation over it was like, is it really that important? What, you know, I mean, we've got so much stuff from, let's say, the Let It Be sessions, right, of the Beatles, you know, just jamming on different things, and it's like, what's the obsession with this?
Right. Well, because it's a newfound shiny object, and people were just, you know, like, oh, what's the story with this? You know, it didn't help that apparently at some point, while interviewed, Walter Shenson, the producer of the film, claimed, yeah, that's the Beatles, without any further backup. And you would have expected in Mark Lewisohn's book, The Beatles Recording Sessions, that it would have come up, you know, some documentation for the Beatles laying down some generic music. And I think for anybody that first heard it in the film, you know, it's got a little bit of a Chuck Berry-ish, I Saw Her Standing There, rock in E tone to it, but not really Beatles necessarily. What I found interesting was this year, when all the attention was coming out, people now were adding to the mix the claim that, oh, it's Jimmy Nicol playing with the Beatles.
Yeah, and there was also people saying, I can recognize Paul's bass playing. And it was like, really?
Yes.
I didn't recognize Beatles in it at all.
No. So there it was, you know, you have all this speculation going on about it, and then the entire 30-odd second clip surfaces. So let's hear that. Now, clearly, you listen to this thing, you know, if there was ever any doubt whether this was or was not the Beatles, that pretty much nails it. That is not the Beatles.
Definitely
certainly
not
Ringo playing drums. No.
No.
No. I mean, it's definitely not George playing lead guitar. You know, if you want to, you know, have your wish fulfillment, well, maybe it's John and Paul in the background with some studio pros. No, it's not. But the great thing
I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, what are the odds that John and Paul would play with studio pros instead of George and Ringo? I doubt it.
Of course not. But, you know, with Beatle people, there's people that want to believe, you know?
Yeah.
And it's in the face of all factual data, which luckily came along with all the attention of the Hard Day's Night reissue with an article that was done in Studio Daily, which is an online magazine. And they talked at length to Giles Martin and the work he did on restoring the soundtrack. And, you know, really, kudos to the guy for what he had to work with.
Yeah.
And restoring the sound, all the dialogue, all the cues, all this, that, and the other thing. Anyway, in there, the subject of the train music came up. And that was where we finally have the reveal. Clem Cattini, you know who he is, right?
Oh, absolutely. Famous session musician.
Yeah, he was all over everything. He's a British session player, you know, a peer of Andy White, if you will.
Yeah,
he was
a drummer. We should say a drummer. I said a musician, yeah. But yeah, a famous drummer.
Yeah. A drummer is distinct from a musician, yes.
Get my digs in.
Yes. But he was in the Tornadoes, apparently, but he also was a guy that played on tons of hit 60s recordings. We're talking about Telstar, of course, but also the early Kink singles.
Yes.
When they, even though Mick Avery was in the group, they were using a session player. So he's on You Really Got Me.
Yep.
And some of that early stuff. He played behind Dusty Springfield, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me.
Mm-hmm.
There was another one of those things that people speculated about for years was Donovan, Hurdy Gurdy Man.
Right.
You know, that was like the earliest incarnation of Led Zeppelin, you know, with Bonham and Page and John Paul Jones on there.
Yes.
No, actually it's Clem Cattini.
Yeah.
And I believe John Paul Jones had a hand in the arrangement and possibly keyboard, but Jimmy Page doesn't happen to be on there.
Also been rumors that Clem played on some Beatles track? Wasn't there some nonsense rumor about that?
Are you thinking of Bernard Purdy?
Well, there was that as well.
Yeah, no, I've never heard it with the Beatles.
Yeah, I thought I read somewhere that Clem was, you know, kind of, you know, trying to claim that he'd played on some Beatles recording or other.
That's very interesting. If he was doing what Purdy did, then that's pretty nonsensical. But,
yeah.
You know, the man has enough credits to his name. Oh, he doesn't have to invent things.
Yeah, but not that stopped people in the past, right? You know?
Right. No, not at all. Yeah. But anyway, Clem stepped forward, said yes, that studio producers and people like George Martin, who worked on soundtracks, were in the habit of, when they had session players assembled, such as they would for A Hard Day's Night, to do, like, let's say, Beast Boy for the Ringo solo scene, and various other non-Beatle music in the film, sometimes if they had the studio time, they would have these guys lay down generic music to be used in various film projects.
Yeah.
And that appears to be the case here. And so Clem Cattini stepped forward and said, yeah, that's me, and it's Big Jim Sullivan, who is another big name, a guitar player. Yes. What's interesting about him, you want to tie it to another Beatle thing, is that around 68 or so, when that Lord Sitar album came out.
Yeah.
You familiar with that?
Yeah.
There was speculation that it was George under a fake name.
Right.
Doing covers of I Am the Walrus and If I Were a Rich Man.
That would have been likely, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But again, you know, people love to attribute, you know, all these wondrous things to the Beatles that they had nothing to do with. Anyway, so Clem Cattini says it's him, Big Jim Sullivan, and he thinks Jimmy Page. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility, but, you know, instead of being the Beatles, it's a pretty good story anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jimmy Page, I think he was on so many sessions, he wouldn't have had time for dinner, you know, but...
Yeah.
and I know he's also laid claim to certain sessions that he was on that it turned out he wasn't on, and he's most likely... I don't know if he's, in his case, feeling the need to fabricate just as much as... He just did so many sessions, you know, it kind of becomes a blur after a time.
I would think so. But yeah, there's been the whole talk about him actually playing the Dave Davis solos on those early Kinks records.
Yeah, and I spoke with Sheryl Talmy, who produced those, and he did recall Jimmy Page being at some sessions, but it was not on those particular tracks.
Good, yeah. I don't think so. I mean, you know, certainly Dave Davis knows he's perfectly capable of playing his own guitar solos, as we know, as was Pete Townsend for Can't Explain. But anyway, speaking of drummers from England named
Clem Burke.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
well, actually, not from England. I mean, Clem is I think a New Yorker, but he's an Anglophile and a big fan of Keith Moon's.
There you go. Yes. Okay. I knew there was some kind of connection. If he's not of English blood, he's pretty close in terms of affinity.
Yeah. I love Clem Burke's drumming. I think it's a fantastic drum.
He's like Keith Moon with a lot more discipline and control.
Exactly.
Which is not to diss Keith Moon.
Right.
He's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Was. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, the ex-Blondie drummer, currently part of this new band called Empty Hearts.
Right. And that leads us into... our interview for this episode, which is with Andy Babuke, who is the author of a really well-respected book, Beatles Gear.
And it is a must-own if you are any kind of Beatle fan. I am not a gearhead, per se. I don't care about, you know, any, you know, particular bridges or tuning keys or any of that stuff. But what is great about this book is you have the story of how these instruments came to be acquired and purchased and when and where. And that, to me, it's the history, and that's fascinating.
And the focus of this show is not really focusing on the Beatles' abilities as musicians as much as the instruments they played and yes. how those influenced the sound, because a remarkable thing, especially if you listen to the earlier albums, is the difference in sound from one album to the next. And it's not all just down to studio techniques or double tracking or, you know, reverb, but it's also the actual sounds. I mean, Hard Day's Night, we've got the Rickenbacker 12 string, and Beatles for Sale, it's that kind of Chet Atkins country sound that George is getting. And
yes.
You know, and so, and that goes on through the albums. And what's interesting, and I think that comes up also in my interview with Andy, is how some of the instruments they acquired weren't intentional, actually. They intended to get something else, and they happened getting, you know, to get something else delivered to them or whatever. And that yes. ended up kind of, you know, coloring the sound of the album they were working on.
Right, exactly. I Feel Fine being a case in point, which you will talk about with Andy in the interview. Let's hear it.
John Lennon acquired his Rickenbacker 325 primarily because it was an American guitar. But the chunkiness of the sound gave his steady, rhythmic style a foundation that the Beatles exploited constantly until around 1965 or so. John's ownership of a Rickenbacker led to George's acquisition of his 12-string guitars and the jangle foundation of the early folk rock movement. Then there was Paul's acquisition of his Hofner 4001, based due to symmetry and affordability. The light, short-scale Hofner had a strong influence on his playing style, enabling him to play the kind of bouncy, melodic bass that had never been heard before, and which a jazz or precision bass would have made difficult because of their scale length and heft. So with this in mind, one of our listeners, Blaine Bowman from Riverside in California, asks, how much do you think the Beatles' accidental acquisition of most of their early equipment influenced who they were musically, and the uniqueness of their fresh and exciting sound?
I think in doing all the research for Beatles gear, I think a lot of the equipment they got wasn't because they were out to study it and get the right sound for the right song. It was really just a matter of kids with no money grabbing whatever they could. You know, John's happenstance of walking into a store and happened to see a Rickenbacker in Germany and buying it, you know, he bought it on purchase hire, put money down, and then it was he never paid for it in full. You know, I mean, that's all kind of a fun, cool thing. In actual fact, George's first Rickenbacker wasn't a 12 string. It was a Rickenbacker 6 string that he bought when he came to visit his sister in 63 here in the United States. So they did have this affection for having similar brand guitars, and I think that goes back to the Shadows and that kind of a thing, where it was kind of accepted to have, you know, suits and matching instruments and matching amplifiers, so you look smart on stage. I don't think they actually picked instruments for certain sounds on the records. I mean, later they did, but early on it was really a matter of what they could afford. A great story is the J160E. You know, in actual fact, what they thought they ordered were Gibson ES-175 guitars. It was a big jazz box. Had they received those guitars, those records would sound drastically different. But they received this J160E acoustic electric, which has a very unique, bizarre sound to it. But that's what helped create their sound. So I think it was more just coincidental, the instruments. I don't think, you know, from what they say, it was not planned.
Were the Beatles cognizant of exploiting these types of things, or were they just making music using the tools at hand, which happened to be an odd and beautiful assortment of instruments, talents, and skill sets?
Absolutely, I would say early on it was just using tools at hand. Later, they were trying to access different types of sounds and having unique things on their records, and we see that throughout their history. And I, you know, show that in the book as well as when I do lectures. I actually play audio clips where you can see the drastic difference. You know, a good example is, and I love her. You know, the original track when they did the demo was with a 12 string and drums, and then by the time they finished, they realized that they needed a different atmosphere, a different mood. So early on, you know, and this is 64, they're smart enough to know that they should use a classical guitar and drop the drums and use bongos. So that was a good case in point of that, you know.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too.
Ultimately, the innovation came from them, not from their instruments, which, after all, their peers also had access to.
I think that's the beauty of it. You know, I grew up, prior to doing the book, you know, I was always mesmerized by, wow, these magical instruments. You know, they were like almost like iconic, you know, the Holy Grail or something, you know. But when I actually got to study it and actually hold some of the instruments and play them and really examine it and look at it from a different viewpoint, it was like, wow, they were just a band. They just did what most bands do. You know, use what you can use to make a cool song and see if we can get through to the other side.
Your new book, Rolling Stones Gear, is, like its predecessor, an exhaustively researched study of every piece of equipment they used. Much has been made through the years of the purported musical rivalry between the two groups. Certainly the Stones, like every other rock act of the day, drew influence from the Beatles. Whether it was as much deliberate copying as John Lennon would claim is open to debate, but there seems to be little overlap in the instrumentation they used. Keith Richards' first electric was a Hofner, and he did play an Epiphone Casino before John or George did, but he wasn't known to play a Rickenbacker. Charlie Watts, influenced by Max Roach, has always played a Gretsch kit and never a Ludwig, as made famous by Ringo. Conversely, though Brian Jones did at least briefly play a Rickenbacker, he's far better remembered for the distinctive teardrop-shaped Vox guitars, the Mark III, the Mark VI, the Mark XII. Excepting their amps, that custom-built guitar oddity recently sold at auction, John's 1965 Python guitar strap and the onstage Vox Continental organ, the Beatles didn't have Vox gear, really. So do you think the two groups recognized how iconic their instrumentation was and therefore purposely steered clear of using the same gear?
No, not at all. First of all, Keith's first guitar was not a Hofner. It was a Valencia, a Galatone, made in South Africa. And it was something that we were able to actually point out to Keith. And as a matter of fact, I bought him one. I found an original old one from the 50s, and I gave it to him. He was pretty blown away by it. And then, you know, as far as the Charlie's first kit, a lot of people don't realize, and I read about this in the book and show great detail about it. Charlie directly bought his Ludwig kit because he liked Ringo's kit. He said so. And he bought it like about 3 weeks after Ringo got his at the same place, at Drum City in London, and he used that Ludwig kit right through 68. So all the early classic Stones recordings were all done on a Ludwig kit, and he said he very much liked Ringo's kit, and he wanted one like it because it was an American kit. And he said the only difference was that he bought the Sky Blue Pearl. The thing with Keith not using a Rickenbacker, he did, and we have it documented in the book, did use a Rickenbacker for a short time live on television, Rick 12-string, but it was Brian primarily. And there became a point in 1965 where Rolling Stones guitars and instruments in general became communal, as opposed to the Beatles camp where they pretty much had their own instruments. In the Stones camp by 65, if there was a guitar, anyone could use it. Even Mick Taylor told me by the time he joined the band, the guitars were very communal.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the influence, I think the real point to be made there is that there were only a handful of manufacturers, and the availability of instruments by the early 60s was limited in the UK because of the trade embargo that was up until 1959. You couldn't import American-made instruments into England, so it was very novel and new. So you're only looking at, you know, 3-4 years of that being available, so it was scarce at best. So they were getting things that were given to them, you know, companies like Vox, they would make them things, you know, the Bill Wyman bass, they made things for Brian. And when I interviewed the guys from Vox, they said the Beatles and the Stones were the two bands they would get everything to. Any new device, anything they made, they'd give it to them to see if they'd use it. And if they used it, 9 times out of 10, they'd put it into production. So it was more of that kind of an atmosphere than it was the band choosing stuff, although they did, you know, and as their careers both moved on, they would often, you know, experiment with different things, trying to find different sounds.
During the Beatles' club performing days, can you give any examples of specific equipment that particularly set them apart from their peers and gave them a signature sound of their own that no one else had? And how do you think their gear stacked up against that of their peers?
Good question. It would be very much the, I would say the Coffin bass amp, the Adrian Barber built. You have to realize there was really no such thing as a bass amplifier in that time period. Vox really wasn't making a proper bass amp yet. So the early, you know, days, you had an AC-30, AC-15, and you'd plug into that with a bass with two 12-inch speakers. It would pretty much blow the speakers out. And 9 times out of 10, they were sharing the same amp. So Adrian Barber had this idea by looking at hi-fi manuals and building a big scooped, you know, cabinet, a reflex cabinet, single 15-inch speaker, a Goodman speaker. And it was, you know, it was really a matter of plywood and just building a big box that would, you know, hold the speaker and give you the sound. But I think, looking at all the other bands that had it, and Adrian Barber told me this, the only other band that had one were the Big Three, and they were known as being a big, loud, ruckus band for a three-piece, and it was because they had loud amplification. AC-30 turned up on full. That could still to this day be a pretty loud freaking amp, but they had a bass amp that would be equivalently loud, and Johnny Gustafson was a killer drummer, so they were a loud, ruckus band.
Hi there, all you cave dwellers. This is Bob Willis saying welcome to the Best of Cellar. We got the hi-fi high and the lights down low, so here we go with the Big Three show. She's a girl with a dapper ring. She knows how to shake that thing. Yeah. What I say, baby, what I say now.
The Beatles had that same kind of punch because they had the bass, they had the Hofner going through this big, you know, reflex cabinet, and so it gave them a different sound, and I think it gave them the edge. Plus, they were good musicians, too.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, the Beatles got by with some really beaten-up gear, didn't they? I mean, there's a prime example has got to be the El Pico amp that Paul brought to the first EMI recording session.
Well, yeah, at that point, you know, I mean, you got to imagine how many crappy shows they did all over, you know. And you know, they were kids, you know. They'd schlep it into the back of a van, no different than bands do now. You're going to gigs, you don't have road cases, you don't have any of that stuff. You just kind of whip it in there. Tubes get loose, it's spurting and sputtering when you plug it in, barely hanging together with bubble gum, you know. You could imagine.
Given how immersed the Beatles were in the music, doesn't it surprise you that early on they weren't more concerned about the state of the gear they used on stage?
I think it was the mentality. It was the mentality at the time of all guitarists. And it was like an amplifier. It just, you know, it was like when you walked into a club, you didn't bring a PA. You just, there was one there and you just used whatever was there. I mean, it's really interesting because when we did the Stones book, even when the Stones, you know, performing 68 in Europe. I mean, they're just using whatever arena PA system was there. It wasn't until 69 that they started to bring their own PA system. So the early days of the 60s, or, you know, late 50s, early 60s, I mean, they used whatever was there, and it was minimum, just junk, basically. So an amplifier was a bit loud, and I think they were more into the songs, really. It wasn't so much about equipment. You know, that kind of mentality, I don't think, came until much later.
We know that in the studio, the Beatles were very fond of subjecting their instruments to various electronic treatments as a way of getting different sounds out of their usual gear. I mean, an example is Paul ran his bass through a fuzz pedal for Think for Yourself. And then there was George feeding his guitar through a rotating Leslie organ speaker for his solo on the Let It Be single, and several other late recordings. They also would often run guitars through the ADT device, notably Eric Clapton's lead on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which gave it a wobbly quality that George considered to be, in his words, more Beatly. All of this was long before foot-activated effects pedals became commonplace. So can you point to an effect that they pioneered that was particularly innovative and distinctive?
Well, it's really interesting because today, you know, guitarists have every device known to man. It's right on your phone, you know. Back then, what I like to point out is, you know, when I do these lectures and stuff, the Beatles had to invent sounds. There was no such thing as, you know, an effects processing. I think the genius of the Beatles, and I think this is what sets them apart from other bands, you know, of their day, early 60s. It's funny because if you study the Beatles, they evolved. There's a lot of other bands that we know and love. They didn't evolve the same way. They kind of stayed in their same, I wouldn't say a rut, because they've produced beautiful, great songs, and they continue to, but the band kind of folded. And a lot of times, you know, there's a lot of bands, you know, that did DC5. There's tons of them that had huge hits, you know, Jerry and the Pacemakers. They never evolved past that initial thing that made them big. They kept on doing the same thing, you know, different songs, but kind of the same orchestration, same arrangement kind of thing. The thing that set the Beatles apart were early on, you know, like the example I gave you with the classical guitar, bringing in different instruments constantly. And if you really study it from that perspective, you'll see that they're constantly striving for a new sound on their record, be it from a bass harmonica to a mellotron. You know, like you mentioned, the ADT thing. Anything to make, you know, things sound different, you know. The direct injection, the whole idea of a DI box. I forget which engineer, I think it was Ken, was telling me that Lennon couldn't understand why he couldn't plug the DI box into his voice. And you know what I mean? I mean, it was all brand new. There was nothing, one thing that set out, you know. The wah-wah pedal was kind of a novelty that Clapton brought back. And, you know, the funny thing about a wah-wah pedal, it was initially designed to be used on a trumpet. It was to produce the wah-wah sound off the front of when you put a thing on the front of a trumpet, Clyde McCoy. But, you know, Clapton figured out how to use it on a guitar and made it popular. And then the Beatles experimented with it across the universe. And, of course, the Stones did. But anything that was new, I almost see that like the bands were telling each other, hey, we got this, hey, you got that, you know?
When I've spoken with producers and engineers down the years who worked in recording studios during the 50s and the 60s, many of them have said that, given the lack of equipment compared to today, when almost any effect can be achieved at the push of a button, they were forced to be more creative, and that in itself was more exciting for them. In the Beatles' case, it was all about pushing the envelope, experimenting with things that had never been done before, wasn't it?
And musicianship. I mean, it fell back on, like, you had to be a good band and, like, have good ideas. And again, with the Beatles, that's why I say the genius of the band was that they'd always strive for something new rather than being complacent with what they had.
So, what's next for you, Andy?
I've been asked to do some books. And I'm so exhausted. The Stones book took me 9 years to do, and it was a really huge thing. I am working on an update to Beatles Gear. We're going to add about 250 pages to it. There's quite a bit of information that's come up since I published it years back. A lot more pictures and stuff. So I'm excited about that. I'll hand that in at the end of this year, and it'll come out next year. So it'll be a totally updated, call it the Ultra Edition or something like that. But in all reality, I'm concentrating on my new band, The Empty Hearts, featuring Clem Burke from Blondie on drums and Elliot Easton from The Cars on lead guitar. And Wally Palmer from the Romantics is the lead singer, rhythm player, playing harp. And Ian McClagan plays keyboards. And I'm the bass player. So I'm a musician too, not just a writer. So I've been so tied up with these books, I like to play as well.
So that was a great talk with Andy. Very illuminating.
Yeah, good guy. And it's just great to speak to someone who's so incredibly well-informed. You know, it's just, it's eye-opening.
Well, he did the work, man. I mean, it's so cool that that particular project ended in exactly the right hands and that the Beatles were so cool about giving him access. You know, I mean, they didn't have to do that. They said no to everything that anybody ever wanted to do. But, you know, his work is invaluable. And people, if you haven't bought Beatles Gear, you might want to wait because apparently they're doing an updated version, newly revised and expanded.
They are. And it is that, you know, there've been loads of these sort of books, you know, different aspects about the Beatles careers. And some of them to me are just completely superfluous. You know, they're sort of
yes.
Get into trivialities. This isn't that book. I mean, this is really, it goes to the heart of, you know, their musicianship in a way, you know, because it's the instruments that they were using to express
themselves.
This is
the tools that they had in their hands to create the magic.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't get more essential than that.
Absolutely.
So, some of the iconic instruments the Beatles used through the years, you know, we should do a little rundown of that.
Yeah.
Probably the most single, apart from maybe Ringo's drum kit, the Ludwig set, is Paul's Hofner bass, that violin-shaped bass.
Absolutely, you know, and it wasn't an expensive bass when he bought it, being Paul, you know.
Right, always quite frugal. Thrifty.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And but he always liked it, didn't he? Because even though it sort of shifted the tuning, he said, it was always basically shifting on the tuning, but it was so light and easy for him to handle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you ever pick one of those things up, that's unbelievable. Very, very light instrument. And yes, it did have a tendency to go out of tune with itself the further you went up the neck. But I think he recognized early on, especially once the fame hit, that it was just iconic. I mean, who else did you see playing a bass like that? I mean, lots of people after the Beatles became famous started picking up on that. But, you know, it was pure happenstance in Germany. He picks up this instrument shaped like a violin, and it's left-handed, and it just gave him a very distinctive look.
It also, it's interesting. I don't know if it's because he started off as a sort of wannabe lead guitarist, but his actual, you know, way of picking up the strings isn't like your typical bass player, is it?
No, no. And yeah, I think you're exactly right. The fact that he was a guitarist, and maybe once he moved to bass, he was still thinking as a guitarist, and certainly he was a quite capable lead guitarist.
Yeah.
You come up with these phenomenal lead bass runs. And again, we don't want to focus on Beatles as performers in this episode. Mm. That'll be another show.
Mm.
But it was amazing how he was such an innovator, and the instrument that he chose was really not something that most serious bass players would have, you know, considered as a serious instrument.
And I don't, you know, who knows what he was thinking when he bought, you know, his first Hofner, but amazing that it was something so unique in appearance, and it would be, it would go on to become the iconic instrument, which I'm sure made him very happy.
Yeah, and he used it well beyond his actual use of it in the studio, because 1965, actually, he'd been given the Rickenbacker 4001 bass. Mm. You want to talk about polar opposite in terms of weight you know, just the heft that thing had. He had been using that as of, I believe, he started using it for Rubber Soul.
Yeah.
But they still had more shows to do, and he kept using the Hofner bass.
Yes, yes.
And the original one he bought was a 1961 model that he got in Germany. I believe it was used when he bought it, which would have been entirely in character for him not to buy a brand new instrument. But that was the one that he had. And then the way you can tell them apart, because in the fall of 63, I believe the Hofner company gifted him with one. And the difference between the two is on the earlier one, the two pickups are close together, yep, closer to the neck, mm-hmm, whereas the 63, when they're spread apart, where one is closer to the bridge. And so when you see pictures of them, and then later on with the 63 bass, that became, as soon as he acquired it, as his newer one, it had less wear and tear on it, that became his main stage and studio instrument, and he used the 61 as a backup. At some point, literally mid-tour in 66, he took the pick guard off, and you see it then when he used it on the rooftop of Let It Be, you know, it's got a different look to it. But
that's the one that's got his handwritten label Bassman on it.
That he had the sticker on that, yes, for Let It Be.
Yeah.
But to this day, he still has the 66 tour set list taped to it.
And what happened to the 61 one? Has he ever wheeled that one back out?
It was seen in the promo for Revolution.
Yeah.
He used it then.
Yeah.
And then apparently he brought it to the Let It Be sessions, because if you look at some of the footage for that promo that was cobbled together for the Ballad of John and Yoko, where they basically ripped some footage from the Let It Be sessions to give this illusion that all four Beatles are playing on it, you see it there. But the story is it got stolen from a storage locker at Twickenham before the end of the Let It Be sessions. And so for the rooftop, he's playing the 63. But the 61 Hofner bass that he got back before they were famous in Hamburg has vanished from the face of the earth. And apparently, you know, it's not surfaced to this point, so if it still exists, it's probably in the hands of some collector who will never, ever let on that he has it.
Really? Amazing. What an amazing story that
sad.
Is.
Yeah. There's been any number of famous instruments that have been stolen through the years that, you know, once the ransom was paid. In fact, there's one of George's that comes to mind. We'll talk a little bit about next couple minutes. But, they tend to show up just because people know they're worth money. But I guess if you're sitting on as iconic and historic an instrument as that, you're not exactly going to broadcast to the world that you own it.
Now, the thing with Paul's bass playing is it just really came on in leaps and bounds. And you can hear the progression, you know, from year to year. But it's interesting that we've actually got, and it wasn't intentional, that we've got a great example of Paul at the height of British Beatlemania in December of 63. And it was a concert at Liverpool Empire that the Beatles did. And it ended up being on broadcast on TV. And the show was called It's the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the songs they perform is Ringo's song at the time, it was Boys. Mm-hmm. And although he also had I Want to Be Your Man up his sleeve, but that's the one that he performs here.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, the mics don't pick him up that well, don't pick up anyone, and it ends up being almost like an isolated bass track.
Yes.
And we
don't have any real true isolations of the instruments for those eras.
Right.
You know, it's not until much later on when they go to four-track, but this happens to be a live recording that apparently, I don't know if it was done as a stereo at the time, you know, maybe two mics on the stage, but the recording you're describing, it's a beautiful isolation of Paul's bass, which in this instance would have been the 63, the newly acquired one.
Yeah, so let's take a listen to that, because this is a great sort of example of where Paul was at as a bass player, let's say, you know, about 2.5 years or whatever before he starts to really blossom on something like Paperback Writer.
Yes.
The next number is a sort of special number, which we only do every night. It's a number which features our drummer, Ringo. And he was going to sing the new number, but he hasn't learned it. So he's going to do the track off the Please Please Me LP. Go, Boys!
Great stuff, that.
Yeah, really fantastic to hear that. You know, you just sort of, I hadn't taken much notice of that until recently, and had reason to listen to that show again. And it was like, my God, we've got Paul on his own there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
And I'm sure that's the way Paul would have wanted it.
Absolutely. Spotlight on him as Ringo's singing. Other iconic instruments, of course, when the Beatles came to America, which is, you know, all that matters, John's Rick 325,
yeah,
that black three pickup guitar, another iconic, distinctive piece of gear.
Absolutely, instantly recognizable, and you know, you can just picture him on stage, you know, legs apart, and he always had a thing of holding his guitar pretty high up, didn't he? I don't know if he just had a very short strap on it, but he liked to have it almost up to, like, to his chest, the guitar.
Yeah, not as bad as Jerry Marsden, but no, pretty high up. And that was something that the Stones always made fun of, particularly Keith. It's, yeah, like, you know, just buy a longer strap.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But obviously it's something he likes, and it was what he was used to. So, yes.
It worked for him. Well, okay, I will tell you this. This is something I can't remember where exactly I picked this up on, but guitar players, guitar techs that were familiar with Lennon said that he was actually kind of a small boned guy and his reach was kind of short.
Mm.
And the Rick 325, I think it's a short scale guitar, like a three quarter size or something,
right,
to where he could play it comfortably,
yeah,
without, you know, needing octopus arms to, you know, master it.
Right.
So that was part of his deal.
Well, maybe also just so damn short sighted, he wanted to be able to see it.
And there is that, sure. I mean, you see him glance down at the neck. You know,
yeah, absolutely.
He originally had that blonde one that he acquired in Hamburg,
yeah,
when they got a bit of money. And yeah, it was, you know, the whole the fascination of having an American-made instrument.
Hmm.
And it was the Rickenbacker. So he had that one. It was blonde. And he eventually got it painted black in Liverpool by somebody, I think it was a cabinet painter or something like that. And so he had that throughout 63. It wasn't until 64 that he got an actual factory-made black 325, and that was the one that he kept using for the next couple Beatle tours.
Yes.
And I think by 65 he played it out, and 66 he's then playing the Epiphone Casino.
I'm trying to think, on All My Loving, is he playing it on that?
He is playing it on that, and we'll save it for another show. There's not a true isolation of that, but I've got in my pocket something that was engineered that we can actually hear the triplet strumming he does on that.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things he was very proud of, and the fact that it took all of his effort to maintain that rhythm is why he doesn't sing the harmony on that track.
Right.
He'll sing the oohs on the chorus with George, but evidently he wanted to focus on his playing. Speaking of Rickenbackers, we have, talk about an iconic thing that literally, it changed the face of rock.
The 12-string Rick.
Yes, that George was gifted with during the February visit for the Ed Sullivan Show by the Rickenbacker folks.
And as you say, it literally changed the face of rock, as, wasn't it Dave Crosby, or was it, no, actually it was Roger McGuinn who said... Yeah.
Jim McGuinn,
yeah, they were this, you know, Greenwich Village folk group or whatever. Well, actually, West Coast, yeah. And they went to see A Hard Day's Night, and it was the Rickenbacker 12-string sound, and boom, we want to do that.
Yes, and that was the thing that George just went hog wild with once he got it in his hands.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was such a guitar geek anyway.
Yeah.
You know, he loved the rockabilly stuff. And, you know, there's so many of those, you know, the Duo Jet that he bought in,
yes,
Hamburg, that, you know, later on showed up on the cover of Cloud 9 after he'd given it to Klaus Voormann for a period of time before he, right, took it back.
Right.
The Country Gentleman, you know, there was all those big distinctive guitars, you know, that he did, like the All My Lovin' rockabilly guitar solo on.
Yeah.
But the Rickenbacker 12-string was a game changer. And the first track they recorded once he got back to England with it was You Can't Do That.
Right.
And he composed the riff for that without credit. And that freed him up, as he played the riff throughout the song, for John to play the guitar solo on.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and it's unimaginable, the title song of A Hard Day's Night without the 12-string.
Completely. And then you just think of where that went, you know, in the next couple of years, mm-hmm, you know, and the Birds with the Bells of Rimney.
Yeah, and, I mean, that was the Bird's signature sound. I mean,
yeah,
you know, the Beatles had enough musical variation that they didn't have to rely on one instrument. You know, it's like they had talked about, John had said, in the context of harmonica, which right. we hadn't talked about yet. But, you know, they used it in the first couple singles, and it said after a while, it became embarrassing. It was like a formula to stick that on their singles.
Right.
So they dropped it by She Loves You.
Yeah.
I don't think he picked it up again. You know, he uses it, I'm a Loser, in the fall of 64, but I don't think he returned to it till they recorded All Together Now.
That's correct. That's absolutely yeah. correct. Yeah.
And then, of course, you heard it on Oh Yoko during the solo years. But, yeah, early on that was a sound for them. But the Rickenbacker 12-string, you know, it just doused all over the Hard Day's Night soundtrack.
Yes.
And not in a bad way.
Right.
And so we'll hear a bit of the Hard Day's Night isolation. You know, you got that fantastic opening chord, which he plays an arpeggio of at the end of the song. And then the following year, 65, they record Ticket to Ride. So their other big single for a film got 12-string on that, played entirely different way.
Yeah.
2, 3, 4.
So 12-string there, and as some people know, that was the album during those sessions for Help that Paul started to usurp some of George's lead guitar duties, playing the fills on Another Girl and also on Ticket to Ride. I mean, George is playing the riff on Ticket to Ride, the opening signature motif, but at the end of the bridge is... That's Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, and I very good impersonation, actually. Can we have a bit more of that? Yeah, okay. All right, that's enough.
We'll phone you.
Yeah.
Okay, so there we go. And
the harmonica, I wanted to say something else about
yeah,
the harmonica.
Yeah, 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 let's go back to that.
Because that John's harmonica that he did use, that you referenced before, was a Hohner. And his first
Was there any other kind?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you.
I wouldn't know.
But what we do know, thanks to Mark Lewis and actually also Alan Williams, I think, you know, Beatles' first manager come booking agent, was
yes,
that...
Yes, in that magnificent book, The Man Who Gave the Beatles Away.
Absolutely, fantastic book. Anyone who hasn't read that, you know, John endorsed it, by the way. John said, you know, it was a great read. And,
yes,
and,
it is.
And in that, he basically explains how John acquired his first harmonica. It was... It was
at least the first recording one, because apparently he'd mastered it as a child, according to Mark Lewison, right?
That's right. Well, in fact, there's a quote of his early on that I think, Greensleeves? I don't know, something. He was learning some classic tunes on it as a kid.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he basically shoplifted while they were in Holland, wasn't it, on the way to Germany.
To Hamburg for the first time,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Slap leather.
Yeah, that's Mark Lewis, and you know, in his book Tune In, basically that was the term that they used amongst themselves. I don't know if it was
very suggestive, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, slap leather. I know it sounds like kind of I don't know, sadomasochism.
Yeah, like they're anticipating their Reaper Bone experience.
So just wanted to give that a name check. Anyway, that was the harmonica.
Yes, and there was other, you know, besides, you know, like I said, Lennon had said that it was becoming too much of a gimmick and it was embarrassing, so they dropped it. But they actually did use it a few more times as color. Thinking of from Magical Mystery Tour, Fool on a Hill.
Yep.
Right? You know, that bass harmonica.
Yes.
I'm not talking about the Hamburg one. And I think, isn't there parts of Pepper? Does Mr. Kite or something have it? No?
I think.
Oh, you know what I'm thinking about? The comb and tissue thing they did for Lovely Rita.
Lovely Rita, exactly. And we got photos of them in the studio doing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not something they repeated.
No. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, now you're talking this period, 65 or so, is where I know the Beatles, John and George had picked up those powder blue Fender Strats.
Yes.
Matching guitars they end up using on No More Man,
yep.
65 Rubber Soul.
Yep.
The year prior to, Paul had picked up his Epiphone Casino. And I'm trying to remember, it was somebody like John Mayall, I think, that had recommended it to him, of all people, the blues guy. And so Paul was the first one to get an Epiphone Casino. And John and George get theirs in 65.
Yes.
And theirs are their tour guitars for 66.
Mm-hmm.
They're matching Sunburst Epiphone Casinos.
Right, there's a photo of them, isn't there, with you know, all posing with those guitars.
Yes, and those are the ones that they used on the 66 tour, although they were experimenting around that time with other guitars as well. And then John had his stripped down to the natural wood.
That's correct, yeah. Well, you see it on the Revolution promo, and you see it most prominently on the rooftop at the end of
yes.
Let It Be.
And it really became his guitar of choice through the end of the Beatles days.
And that was done really to give it a different sound, wasn't it? To let it breathe more.
Yes. Yeah, I think that was the thinking behind it. And it was the guitar that, I mean, really, to exclusion of anything else, he used for the rest of his days.
Yes.
In the Beatles.
Yes.
And now, I there was an anecdote I heard from a guy that had been a famous studio session player, and then he worked with Joe Jackson's band. Later on. Mm. And apparently when he was a teenager and his sister worked for Apple on Broadway
yeah.
in the early 70s. And the story he tells is that, you know, he's a Beatle crazy guy and had begged her to let him come to the office. And I guess on a weekend, she finally relented, let him come and take a look around and help with some busy work. And while he was there in like one of the offices, he spotted the stripped Epiphone Casino of John Lennon. And he's already a guitar player at this point,
yeah.
So he can't help himself. You know, he takes it out of the case, and he's holding it in his hands, and he said he was appalled at how filthy the strings were, like they'd never, ever been changed.
Wow.
And I've heard stories like James Jamerson from Motown, the Funk Brothers,
oh, yeah.
Never changed his bass strings because he thought it was essential to his sound.
Right.
And when I heard that story, I was thinking, oh, you know, because John always tended to favor kind of a dirty guitar sound. You know, when you hear it, when they're
literally.
Doing the... Yeah, literally dirty. When they're doing the trading off of the solos on the end.
Yes.
You know, I could totally picture that thing being gritty and grimy, and because yeah. he's doing that grinding kind of sound as opposed to the clean sounds of Paul and George.
Well, even on You Can't Do That, his lead yes. playing, it's raw. I mean, that was his style. But as
yes.
you said, yeah, the visual of it is a sort of
yeah.
grimy guitar.
Yeah, you got to wash your hands after that, so...
I want to do it now, just hearing about it.
Yeah, exactly. So, what other...
we should listen to what he did. I mean, a great example of the casino sound is on She Said, She Said.
Yes, exactly. And I'm not sure what George is playing on that, guitar-wise. We know he's playing bass, because I talk about it in my Revolver book. But, yes, guitar, John, very distinctive. Let's hear it. There you go, with that great isolation of the guitar track of She Said, She Said.
Yeah, I love that, actually. I love hearing those isolated tracks, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Puts you in the studio with them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, speaking of bass, I mean, that song we talk about, you know, well, we haven't talked about ourselves, but the whole bass issue with that was where Paul walked out of the studio and therefore was not around for the recording of that. Where he was around that year, of course, was the experiment they did for the recording of the paperback writer Rain single.
Yes.
Where they used the bass speaker, just an actual like 15-inch speaker as a microphone to capture that big, deep bass sound for the single.
And I mean, that is a total departure. I mean, for me, Paul goes to a whole other level here as a bass player because, yep, he's using a different instrument. He's using,
yes.
Yep, the Rickenbacker 4001.
Mm-hmm.
And, so suddenly, you know, you've got, in the photos, you've got that different look.
Yes.
But the other thing is, for me, I just describe it as lead bass. Suddenly, he's not just, you know, playing those bass fills. I mean, it's like you hear the lead guitarist coming out on bass.
Yes, and I do think that not only knowing that he could be heard was inspiring him because of the different recording technique they applied to the bass, but also the fact that he had this wonderful instrument that he'd been given, I think, back in 64, the Rickenbacker 4001.
Yeah.
But he didn't actually start using it on Beatles sessions until the Rubber Soul sessions. And I think the first thing he used it on was that fuzz bass part for Think for Yourself.
Right. But would you agree with me that it's like, at this point in 66, with Paperback Writer, that really Paul starts to get attention as a musician, you know, as opposed to a composer and a singer? Suddenly people start to really take notice of the bass playing. I'm not sure if they were doing so before that.
No, I agree. And I do think that the proof is in the pudding. When you look at the stuff that came out of the Revolver sessions, you know, the bass lines, Paperback Writer, Rain, two phenomenal bass lines,
yeah,
using that Rick bass and those recording techniques,
yeah,
which they didn't apply to the album cuts, but it's still there. You know, you hear stuff like Andrew Bird Can Sing. You know, he's got that great walking bass line that it's just so orchestrated around the guitar riffs and the sort of chiming rhythm guitar. And again, I don't want to start getting into performances, but there it is as something that these guys were totally arranging and working out. And it's just beautiful how it all meshes together.
Why would you think that after that he would even go back to the Hofner? What is it about the Hofner? I'm not talking about performing with it on stage, but in terms of just, you know, in the studio.
I do think that, you know, where he does return to it was the Let It Be sessions.
Mm.
And that was their conscious effort to get back, to be a little rock and roll band again. And maybe he was trying to go for that Hamburg/Cavern feel,
yeah,
of what it was like to be, you know, four guys standing up and performing.
And maybe mindful of the fact that, you know, it, as initially conceived, it was going to be either a TV show or it'd be a live concert. And
yes,
so maybe he was thinking in that context as well.
Exactly. That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Speaking of Paperback Writer, there again you have a change of instrumentation from George now, who's playing the Gibson SG.
Yes, absolutely.
That nice sharp toned instrument. If you ever handled one, they're fairly light. Mm. It's not like, you know, a Tele or anything like that. But he didn't use it a lot. You see it in the promos for Paperback Writer and Rain, and then for the promo for Lady Madonna, which is actually them doing Hey Bulldog.
Right, right, absolutely. And you know what became of that SG?
Yeah, he gave it to Pete Ham from Badfinger.
Yeah.
Or Pete'em, as you Brits would say.
Pete'em, there you go.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the story about that, because, you know, Pete Ham was seen using it on some of their early TV performances. The fate of it, after his 1975 suicide, a story got round that, although he wasn't married to her, Ann Ferguson, who was his widow,
yeah,
the story was that she had sold it at a garage sale. You know, this historic George Harrison-owned Gibson SG. Well, it was an urban myth. That
right.
was not true.
Right.
In fact, it had been given to Pete's brother, John, who owned a music shop in Swansea. Hmm. And it did surface years later. He'd had it all along. And I think it was about 10 years ago, it went up for auction. And the owner of the Colts football team bought it for over $500,000.
Lucky that George wasn't around for that.
Yeah, I think you would have been appalled, actually.
So let's take a listen to the Paperback Writer track, though.
Paperback Writer! Dear sir or madam, will you read my book? It took me years to write, will you take a look? It's based on a novel by a man named Lear, and I need a job, so I want to be a paperback writer. Paperback writer!
You know, we were talking before about how the different sounds of different albums.
Yes.
And I think, you know, when we get to the Help album, it's a kind of Hammond organ sound. You hear yes. you know, a lot of Hammond organ on there. Mm-hmm. And the other instruments that we've already mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then when you get to the Rubber Soul, and specifically the We Can Work It Out single, for instance.
Oh, yes.
One, you know, another sort of predominant sound there is the harmonium.
Yes.
And which is,
yeah, it's very misleading to people that if you see the We Can Work It Out promo, and John is seated at that electronic keyboard, you know, if you don't know, you think that's a harmonium. It's not.
Right.
What you hear is a harmonium. What you're seeing is something else. But an actual harmonium is a pedal-pushing instrument.
It is, and it's weird. I suppose you know, they were in a TV studio or whatever, weren't they, doing those promos? So,
yeah, ITV.
Yeah, so they weren't going to lug the harmonium in there. But
right.
as you said, it is misleading. He's getting that sound out of that little electronic keyboard.
Right, and in fact, it's something that actually, I can't remember what track it was, but I think it was George Martin when he was playing harmonium on Mr. Kite.
Yeah.
And it complained how it was exhausting because the physical effort in pushing down those footboards to pump the air into the bellows,
yeah.
it actually wore him out, you know, take after take.
Yeah.
But it's a great, you know, it's almost like a keyboard accordion type of instrument.
It is. It's got such a smooth sound, you know. And
yeah.
I don't mean that in a kind of slick way, but it's just a beautiful sound.
Yeah, it's organic is what it is.
Yes.
It doesn't sound electronic. And so, you know, they used it to great effect on We Can Work It Out. You hear it on The Word from the Rubber Soul Sessions.
Yeah.
It's on Mr. Kite. It's on The Inner Light.
Yes. But, you know, that's why, you know, another one of many reasons to love the Beatles is that they, you know, hit upon these great sounds and they use them for a time and it'll be, like you say, dominating an album or whatever. But they don't just stick with that. They move on to something else.
Yes, they don't play them out to death as a formula or as a gimmick. It's just as Ringo's skill set was to know how to recalibrate his approach to play to the song. And that's how they approached the instrumentation. You know, they would experiment. When I did the Revolver book, I talked about how through Anthology, we have that little segment of rehearsal for I'm Only Sleeping, where they're playing vibraphone.
Yes.
They tested it out. It didn't get the effect they wanted. They set it down, never returned to it. But, you know, it shows, you know, if that tape had been wiped, we'd have had no idea they'd even done that. Yeah. But so for harmonium, you know, again, they set it down, picked it up again in 68 during the White Album sessions for Cry Baby Cry.
Yes. And again, used to great effect on that track.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a mostly kind of acoustic track anyway, so it works really well. Let's hear a bit of it without and with, just to have a little taste test here.
Cry, baby, cry. Make your mother sigh.
I believe that there is a harmonium throughout the Wonderwall sessions as well. You very well familiar with that album?
I'm familiar with it, but not that familiar with it, to be honest. So not one of my favorites.
Well, harmoniums were big in India. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yes. You know, some things are big in Japan. That was big in India. For real. Anyway, on that note, speaking of India, we haven't mentioned sitar to this point.
And what a huge move again by George there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, another one. I mean, just what a fantastic thing that, you know, the first person to really bring Indian or Eastern sounds into Western pop.
Yes, successfully, because apparently, you know, he did it with Norwegian Wood.
Yeah.
But earlier that year, the Yardbirds were attempting to do it for Heartful of Soul.
Right.
And couldn't quite get it to record properly. And there have been other Indian-sounding things in rock records that predated Norwegian Wood, like See My Friend by the Kinks.
Yes.
That sort of droning thing going on. But yes, you know, George takes the prize because he was the one who was able to pull it off.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, that was just the beginning, wasn't it? They inserted it into that song. And it does work beautifully well. But then after that, he's going to kind of really run with that a bit. I mean, we should mention that it was on the set of Help. Actually,
yes.
That, you know, I think it's that scene at the Indian restaurant where you have the Cockney Indians outside the restaurant, you know, one sort of going, "Oi, Abdul."
and they're playing Beatles songs, the Indian band inside the restaurant.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
and Indian instrumentation. But yeah, and then he got more interested when David Crosby of the Byrds started actually turning him on to Ravi Shankar Records. You know, this is something we can have a fuller discussion of when we do the performing show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
We didn't want you to think that we were ignoring it completely, because
right.
we're not.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's no way in one show we can get into all of their instruments. So, you know, don't moan and bitch if it's something that we've left out here, but we're just trying to hit the highlights.
Yeah, like the tambura, for instance.
Yep, absolutely. Right. And the tabla.
Used on Tomorrow Never Knows. Brian Jones picks it up and uses it in Street Fighting Man.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, Brian Jones used the sitar fantastically on Paint It Black.
Yes.
But again, it was George leading the way.
Right. And as John would have it, everything the Beatles did, the Stones did 3 months later.
Yeah, there you go.
Uh-huh. All right. Speaking of George, there is the Les Paul that he used, that actually was given to him by Eric Clapton.
Yes. That's right.
He was a 57.
Yeah, well, they did trade instruments, didn't they? Because it's like George gave Eric the guitar that he played on While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yes. And that's something Andy actually talks about in his Rolling Stone book, is how there was a sort of community property with the instruments within the Stones. They just, you know, after a certain time, there was no such thing as a Keith guitar and a Brian Jones guitar. You know, everybody used everything.
Yeah.
And I think within that circle, certainly between Eric and George, they would, you know, use each other's guitars. And, you know, the things just got handed around. I know that the one in that George was given by Eric, that you see him play in the Revolution promo, and apparently it's the same one that he did the guitar solo for something on, was a 57 Gibson Les Paul. The first owner of it that we know anything about, obviously not from 57, was John Sebastian of Loving Spoonful.
Right.
And then he had it, talking about your East Coast folkies, then Rick Derringer had it for a while.
Right.
Right. Of McCoy's at the time.
Yeah.
And then somehow passed on to Clapton's hands, and he then gave it to George.
Right. Now, can you say the name of the guitar again slowly for us?
57 Gibson Les Paul.
Right.
Standard.
Right. Les Paul, right? That's how you say Les Paul.
What do you say, Les Paul?
No, that's what they say in Paris.
Okay.
In England, it's Les Paul, you know, like a Z, or as we would say, a Z. Sorry for inventing the language.
And perfected in America by Americans.
But I know, what a bummer. But so Les Paul, and great story is that when George, I think in the late 80s maybe it was, that he was interviewed for Guitar Player magazine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, American journalists traveled to the UK and went to George's Friar Park home in Henley-on-Thames. And got to see George's collection. And at some point, he refers to, I don't know if it was the 57 or one of, you know, but he refers to one of the guitars and he says, oh, you know, Les Paul. And George, quick as a tack, never one to miss up an opportunity. When he hears Les Paul, he goes, that's what we could have done within the Beatles.
Oh, man.
Yeah, really. No bitterness there.
Quick on the draw, that George.
Yeah, really, our George.
That's great. All right, well, now that we're kind of in 68 and Revolution and Guitar Gently Weeps, that period, it's worth talking about the Fender instruments that the Beatles were gifted by Fender, which extended to the amplifiers they were using.
Yes.
Very distinctive, what they had gotten their hands on was the Fender 6 bass, a 6-string bass made by Fender.
Right.
And you see George is actually handling it in the Hey Jude promo.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as actually using it goes, it's what you hear on Back in the USSR.
Yeah, that's right. And, it just gives more scope, doesn't it? I mean, how would you sort of describe the need to use the 6-string versus the 4-string?
Well, you know, for that particular track, they were going for that sort of Beach Boys / Chuck Berry sound.
Yeah.
You know, very basic rock and roll. And I don't know if just simply because it was laying there as part of this package from Fender that they picked up on it, but, you know, you consider the recording of Back in the USSR. Ringo has just walked out, so now Paul is manning the drums, so who gets to play bass but one of the Beatles guitar players? And so, and in fact, I think it's John, or is it George? I'm not sure which one of them is manning it on Back in the USSR.
Yeah, I think it's George. I may be wrong there. I mean, the thing is, though, obviously, you know, they want to lock in the bass and drums together. Mm-hmm. But at that point, they, you know, they can record them on separate tracks. It's, yeah. It's interesting that, you know, Paul doesn't end up overdubbing his bass part.
No, like he did on Dear Prudence, which was also cut yes. during that time
right.
with him on drums.
Right.
Yeah. And maybe because I guess what they ended up with was usable enough for such a basic track, you know, basic rock and roll. Whoever manned it did a good enough job to get through it. And we'll hear a bit of it isolated right now so you can see what it sounds like in all its glory. So, moving on from that performance during the late summer, fall of 68, let's go later that year, post-White Album. The White Album comes out. Now, Ringo, to this entire time, you know, when he joined the Beatles, he was playing a Premier kit. And,
yep.
You know, that was something Keith Moon used a lot, Premier drum kits.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't the iconic kit, and it was the Ludwig kit that he got pretty early on after he joined the Beatles. Probably had a bit of money in his pocket. His first new kit came from America, from Chicago, actually.
Yep.
And that was the one with that pearl finish that became the iconic Beatle Ringo drum kit.
Now, one second, when did he acquire that?
63, I believe.
Right, because, you know, the first sort of, well, when we first see Ringo with the Beatles, he's just got that really badly pasted Ringo Starr lettering on the bass drum, doesn't he, on the bass skin.
Yeah, you see that in the photos, the first pictures of Beatle or of Ringo taken with the Beatles as a Beatle were taken at the Cavern where they're rehearsing for the Granada TV thing.
Right.
And, yeah, he's got the Ringo Starr lettering and tape on his drum kit.
Yeah.
And then you see the logo they cobbled together of Beatles and that script with the antennas coming out of the B.
That's right, yeah, the sort of Beatle antennas coming out. That was their early one. I don't know actually who designed that, but...
I thought it was Paul that at least conceived it, if not executed
it. It's actually not bad. I mean, it's kind of, you know, now we look at it and think, oh, it's kind of corny, but it was pretty cool for the time.
I suppose.
Yeah, but then, well, obviously you're not convinced.
Just being diplomatic here.
Yeah, I could tell. And but then, yeah, we get to the iconic lettering, don't we? You know,
yes,
and,
the drop T.
Yeah, but the original one with the antenna that was on the Ludwig kit or on the Premier.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture it in my mind's eye. There's that picture of them on a little stage, and John's like leaning to talk to somebody in the audience. You know that picture I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Yeah, it was in Beatles Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's there, and I believe that's late 62.
Right.
So the actual appearance of the first Beatle or Ludwig drum kit, I'm pretty positive that the drop T was on that. I don't think that the Beatle with the antenna thing was on that kit.
Right.
So
yeah.
Maybe they changed at the same time.
Right, exactly.
Oh, there is a TV appearance of them with the antenna thing.
Yes, there is, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I believe that's it was promoting Love Me Do.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, well, let's say for our purposes, 63. You know, if you want to find out, listeners, just pick up Andy's book.
Yeah, exactly.
Which you should do anyway. Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, Ringo's...
So he's pretty consistent all through their touring years with... Yeah, he had a couple versions of it, but it was the same kit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Now, there was one that got destroyed in a fire in the Hollywood Hills, wasn't there?
Yeah, and like I said, he had, I think, two or three versions of that kit.
Yeah.
And, you know, he changed the drum head to that psychedelicized one for Magical Mystery Tour.
Yes.
Love, Three Beatles. Yeah. And then I did not notice in the pictures I've seen of the White Album sessions, you don't really get a good look at his kit.
Mm.
So I don't know if he was still using that drum head then. It does show up in the Hey Bulldog promo.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's got it going into 68. But the end of 68, post-White Album sessions, he gets a new kit from Ludwig. It's called the Hollywood kit. It's got two shell-mounted toms. So now he's got, you know, instead of just the one and the floor tom, now he's got another one.
Yeah.
Which, again, would inform his fill style that year. And, off, you know, came in handy for when he got around to doing the drum solo on Abbey Road, of course, having an extra tom there.
And actually, something else I want to add, even though, again, we're not focusing specifically on their musicianship, but it's important to say that, you know, George Martin, interview that's in my latest book, Beatles 101, in there he mentions that, you know, whereas Ringo may not have been, like, the most technical of drummers when you stack him up against, you know, some of his peers.
Yes.
But that he had not only a style that was all his own, but he also tuned the drums, you know, in a way that no one else did. He just got a completely unique sound.
Yes, and I think that was what George Martin had to say in terms of high praise for Ringo, is that he really knew how to get sounds out of his kit. And speaking of somebody who's played drums, you know, that's no small thing.
Right.
Because there's a lot. I mean, it's like tuning a sitar, to tune all your drums and all the tuning keys just so to get a good sound. Plus the other things he did, too, for dampening.
Yeah.
You know, I think Jeff Emmerich takes credit for sticking the blanket in the kick drum and pulling the front skin off.
Yeah.
You know, that may be or may not be. I'm not going to argue with it right now. But there was certainly a lot of Beatle recording done with tea towels dampening the toms.
Yes.
Throughout their career.
Yeah.
And you can definitely hear the difference. Like, Hey Jude being an example, you know, when he does that opening fill where he comes in, it's got a more muffled thump to it.
Right.
As opposed to the more ringing out sound you hear on, like, A Day in the Life or Strawberry Fields.
Right. And the thing is about Ringo's drumming, and people often just put that, oh, that's down to his ability or lack thereof. It isn't. But he was understated as a drummer in the Beatles, you know, and that's what's just so wonderful about his playing, is that he, you know, this isn't Keith Moon, and that's nothing to denigrate Moon. That's what worked for The Who.
Yes.
But you know, Ringo doesn't try and dominate. Ringo provides the Beatles with what they need, and he never overworks his part, does he?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't call attention to himself.
Right.
It's like, you know, what they say about actors, if you don't notice they're acting, then they're doing their job.
Absolutely.
You know, that's him as a drummer.
Yeah.
He compliments the song.
Yeah.
And the fact is that you can enjoy the song and may not even in your own mind deconstruct exactly why you're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's not dominating it.
Right. Absolutely.
But he's adding exactly the right color.
And that's the other thing, you know, again, about, you know, George Martin said, you know, he may not have had, like, you know, quartz accuracy, you know, timing on everything, but he was rock solid, and it was the feel. You know, and that's, I mean, that's just so important in any form of the arts and in musicianship, the feel that he brings to it. And again, I think that's, you know, people who are, like, uninformed, basically, about this, you know, they sort of, you know, put him down, and they really don't get it. They don't get what he was doing here. He was really doing something that was every bit as vital as what everyone else was doing in that band.
That is absolutely true. And I think in the minds of the uninformed, they sort of conflate this goofy image he had, you know, in the Beatle films and the Beatle cartoons, that he was just some, you know, lucky cipher.
Yeah, the lucky thing, isn't it, is that he came in at the end, you know, he replaced Pete Best, and he just stumbled in there, and he was lucky. And not the case at all. And again, in Mark Lewisohn's book, it becomes so clear about how he was, like, one of the top guys in Liverpool, you know.
Yes.
And they really wanted him in that band, and he gelled with them personality-wise, he gelled with them musically. And they knew how much they needed him. And boy, did they show it when he walked out during the White Album sessions.
Absolutely. He was key.
Yeah.
They were making it to a certain point without him. With him, took it to the next level.
Yes.
And at exactly the right moment in their careers. They just took off.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you cannot underestimate his contributions. And anybody that does is a fool.
Yeah, exactly. And as I said, this wasn't supposed to be about the musicianship so much, but I think it was, you know, we should make that point because we haven't really spoken much about Ringo in the previous shows, and that's, like, an important thing to say.
Yeah, and we will in the future, promise.
Yeah, we
do. But getting back to this particular kit, another thing that set it apart, besides having an extra tom, was that it had actual calf skin drum heads.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hate the whole thought of that as a vegetarian. But nonetheless, Ringo himself in interviews said that it was all organic. You have wood hitting skin, and that it inspired him in his fills to, you know, do something slightly different in his approach.
Right.
And, you know, you hear a different, you know, all those tom-tom solos he does, or it's not solos, but fills he does throughout 1969 in the recordings.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely, you could tell the difference that he's, you know, doing something different in his own head. And we'll go to the actual last Beatle original recording session, January 1970, to hear him and Paul isolated from I, Me, Mine. Those two locked in together, playing on a new Beatles song for the last time.
So fantastic to hear that, you know.
Yeah, it must have been a little bittersweet, don't you think?
Yeah.
They kind of knew that they were just, you know, tidying up the loose ends at this point.
Right, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, they know that John's out of it already.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but just great to hear that the bass and the drums locked in there together. You know, it's the amount of material we've got to listen to, not just the catalogue, but mm-hmm. all the variations on that catalogue, if you like, all the different elements that we've now got.
Yeah.
Just really, you never get bored.
No. I mean, it's just the riches that we have.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other rock act that gets so much of its minutiae scrutinized to such depth as these guys. But the reward is, it's fascinating.
It is. That's the thing. It's worthy.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
As, you know, we will continue to see coming out in, you know, future books and projects and things. I mean, there's no end to it, and I don't think we've reached the bottom yet. There's just a lot more to uncover and understand and learn.
And we'll be doing that in future shows. You see, what a smooth transition that was.
Oh, look at you. What a pro.
I know.
I've so elevated you.
I know. All right, well, that's the end of another episode.
I'm Robert Rodriguez.
I'm Richard Buskin.
And this Thanks for is listening.
Something About the Beatles.
Something About the Beatles. Recorded at Strad Studios. Produced by Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.